From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
What we've seen the last few days is nothing less than the final verdict on an economic philosophy that has completely failed.
Top of our economy is broken. We've seen self-interest, greed, irresponsibility, and corruption undermine the hard work of the American people.
The U.S. government seizes control of insurance giant American International Group in an unprecedented $85 billion bailout. The move comes as a series of financial crises has altered the landscape of Wall Street. Then Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin and global warming. We go to Anchorage to speak with a University of Alaska professor who says she misrepresented state scientists' findings on endangered polar bears, then tried to cover it up. Then to Bolivia, where President Evo Morales is accusing right-wing governors of trying to stage a violent coup. He's already expelled the U.S. ambassador. The U.S. government tells all Americans to leave Bolivia. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. government's announced its second major financial bailout this month, agreeing to take over the troubled insurance giant American International Group, or AIG. At an $85 billion cost, the New York Times calls it the most radical intervention in private business in the central bank's history. The AIG bailout comes just weeks after the government takeover of the federally chartered mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. More on this story after headlines. The troubles on Wall Street continue to dominate talk on the campaign trail. In Colorado, Senator Barack Obama blamed the economy's woes on Bush administration policies.
What we've seen the last few days is nothing less than the final verdict on an economic philosophy that has completely failed. And I am running for president of the United States because the dream of the American people must not be endangered anymore.
Meanwhile, Senator John McCain has backtracked from previous comments. The fundamentals of the American economy are strong. Campaigning in Miami, McCain said the top of the economy is broken.
The top of our economy is broken. We've seen self-interest, greed, irresponsibility, and corruption undermine the hard work of the American people. It's time to set things right, and I promise to get the job done as your president.
In other campaign news, the Obama camp has filed a suit to block a controversial voter suppression tactic in Michigan. The Republican Party in Macomb County admitted this week it plans to use a list of foreclosed homes to block people from voting on Election Day. The plan is likely to disproportionately affect African Americans, who are overwhelmingly Democratic voters. In Michigan, more than 60% of all subprime loans were made to African Americans. McCain's regional headquarters are housed in the office building of foreclosure specialists Trott and Trott. In Iraq, General Ray Odierno has replaced General David Petraeus as the top military commander of the U.S. occupation. Petraeus oversaw the so-called U.S. surge that increased the occupation by 30,000 troops. On Tuesday, hundreds of residents of the Baghdad district of Sadr City protested the visit of Defense Secretary Robert Gates to Iraq. Gates was in Baghdad for the transfer of command to General Odierno. Saeed al-Husseini of the Sadrist movement said the U.S. has ignored Iraqi public opinion.
Big demonstrations have been staged in front of the office of Sadr to condemn and denounce the visit of the U.S. Defense Secretary, because these people refuse the visits of any U.S. officials whilst demanding the pullout of U.S. occupation gradually from Iraq or issue a timetable for their withdrawal.
In Yemen, at least 16 people have been killed in an attack on the U.S. embassy in the capital Sana'a. A suicide bomber reportedly drove a vehicle into the embassy compound, followed by armed militants who opened fire. It's the second attack on the U.S. embassy in Yemen this year. In Afghanistan, four troops in the U.S.-led coalition have been killed in a roadside bombing. 2008 has already passed last year as the deadliest so far for the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. In other news from Afghanistan, new details are being revealed about U.S. plans to expand its main prison there, Bagram Air Base. USA Today reports the Bush administration will increase so-called intelligence operations at Bagram. The Pentagon seeking to hire more interrogators to question prisoners and provide intelligence for battlefield operations. The U.S. plans to increase Bagram's capacity from 600 to 1,000 prisoners. Several former prisoners have described conditions of harsh torture at at the Bagram jail. In Bolivia, opposition governors have agreed to talks with President Evo Morales amidst an ongoing political crisis. On Tuesday, Bolivian troops arrested opposition governor Leopoldo Fernandez of the Pando province. Fernandez was accused in the massacre of up to 30 peasant Morales supporters last week. Government Minister Susana Rivero said the government had approved martial law in Pando in response to the killings.
The Bolivian government has made a decree of martial law in the department of Pando, and the military forces of the nation are authorized by the Constitution to enter and to do that work that corresponds.
The opposition governors have rejected Morales' plans to redistribute Bolivian oil wealth to its indigenous majority. Last month, Morales won a critical referendum on his presidency with more than 60% of the vote. We'll have more on Bolivia later in the broadcast. In Haiti, relief efforts slowly continue following weeks of deadly tropical storms and hurricanes. Some 1,000 people have been killed and more than a million displaced since the first storm hit the island last month. The city of Gonaive remains vulnerable to waterborne disease as residents try to salvage the remains of their homes. Rafael Trinard of the World Food Program said the combination of health risks and desperate residents have forced food distribution to move outside the city.
We started last week by distributing food within the city in various areas in the city, but it has been quite difficult because of the tension in the city and for security reason and for health reason, because it to avoid to have the beneficiaries at risk in the pressure of a crowd, we decided to have the food distribution centers a little bit outside of the city for the moment.
The Bush administration has pledged just $10 million to emergency relief in Haiti. Gonaive resident Nadeg Yom appealed for more Western aid.
We would like to ask people to help take care of us because children can't bear this. We are older and can spend 2 days without eating, but children can't. I have 2 children. One is 8 and the other one is 4 years old.
Meanwhile, in Cuba, the Cuban government has announced that total damage from back-to-back hurricanes will top $5 billion. Hurricanes Gustav and Ike damaged areas across the island with more than 60,000 homes destroyed. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has rejected a Cuban plea for a temporary lifting of the U.S. embargo. Cuba said it would use the repeal to buy desperately needed supplies from North American companies. But the White House says it would only offer Cuba $2 million in relief aid. The White House initially offered just $100,000, but increased the figure after coming under criticism. In a statement, the Cuban Foreign Ministry responded, quote, "Our country cannot accept a donation from the country that blockades us." In Colombia, another former paramilitary fighter has implicated the top Colombian military commander in collaborating with death squads. In videotaped testimony, Luis Adrian Palacio said he witnessed General Mario Montayo funnel weapons to a Medellin militia in April of 2002. Government prosecutors say they've opened a preliminary investigation into Montayo based on the new allegations. 4 other former paramilitaries have also implicated Montayo. Dozens of others have also linked top Colombian military and intelligence officials to working with death squads since the early 90s. Colombia is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the Western Hemisphere. And in Israel and the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas held their meeting Tuesday before Olmert's Kadima party picks a new leader. Abbas said Palestinian demands remain as they always have, a state in the West Bank and Gaza, and the right of return for displaced refugees.
We demand East Jerusalem as a capital of Palestine, and it is land occupied since 1967. We demand the right of return to refugees. We demand the 67 borders. We demand rights to West Bank water. We demand security and peace. And even many in Israel say that settlement activity is illegal, and we say this is illegal.
Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni and Transportation Minister Shaul Mofaz are the leading candidates to replace Olmert. Mofaz has recently come under scrutiny after it was revealed he called for the mass killing of Palestinians while commanding the Israeli army during the Second Intifada. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. government seized control of insurance giant AIG, American International Group, in an unprecedented $85 billion bailout. The Federal Reserve made the deal Tuesday to save AIG from collapse in what the New York Times describes as the most radical intervention in private business in the central bank's history. The move to lend AIG up to $85 billion for 2 years in exchange for nearly 80% of its stock effectively nationalizes one of the central institutions in the crisis that has swept through financial markets this month. AIG found itself on the verge of bankruptcy, largely because of complex securities that are tied to subprime home mortgages and which plunged in value as the nation's housing crisis deepened. The bailout marks a turnaround by the Bush administration and the Fed, who just 2 days earlier had refused to risk taxpayer money to prevent the collapse of Lehman Brothers or the distressed sale of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America. It also comes on the heel of a government bailout just over a week ago of mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and 6 months after the Fed bailed out Bear Stearns by helping to finance a sale to J.P. Morgan Chase. The unprecedented run of events has altered the shape of Wall Street and brings the total amount of government rescue efforts to stabilize the financial system and housing market to about $900 billion. For more, we're joined by two guests. Naomi Prinz is a former investment banker turned journalist. She used to run the European Analytics Group at Bear Stearns. She's now a senior fellow at Demos. She's the author of two books, Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket. Michael Hudson is the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, an economics professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Super Imperialism, the Economic Strategy of American Empire. He is also was chief economic advisor to Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. He is currently as well as when he was presidential candidate. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Naomi Prinz, let's begin with you. The bailout of AIG.
The bailout of AIG is an example of the government having to step in and clean up a mess. It is not so much that subprime mortgages fell and that caused some losses to AIG. AIG was acting not simply as an insurance company, it was acting as a speculative investment bank slash hedge fund, as was Bear Stearns, as was Lehman Brothers, as is what will become Bank of America Merrill Lynch. So you have a situation where it's bailing out not just the money, but taking on the risk of items it cannot even begin to understand, because if it had understood them, this would never have gotten to the point to which it has gotten.
How did it get to this point? How did it go beyond insurance?
In AIG and in Lehman and with Merrill and every other company on Wall Street that has faltered or is faltering, it's about taking on too much leverage, in borrowing to take on the risk, and borrowing again and borrowing again. 25 to 30 times the amount of capital, the amount of money that they had to basically back the borrowing that they were doing. Human regular borrowers cannot do this. This is something that is an item only of the banking industry. And not only was all that borrowing happening, but there was no transparency to the Fed, to the SEC, to the Treasury, to anyone who would have even bothered to look as to how much of a catastrophe was being created, so that when anything fell, whether it was a subprime mortgage or whether it was a credit complex security, it was all below a pile of immense, interlocked, incestuous borrowing. And that's what is bringing down the entire banking system.
Michael Hudson, we're talking government bailout, which means taxpayers stuck with the bill. Do you think this is the right move?
No, it's the worst possible move, and it puts the class war back in business with a vengeance. Wall Street's been preparing for this for years, because every financial analyst knows that the debts can't be paid. And the question that Wall Street has, if you're going to take a gamble on bad debts that can't be paid, how are you going to come out a winner? And there's only one way of coming out a winner, and that chance to make the government bail you out. This has been known for years because it's inherent almost in the mathematics of compound interest. Every banker I know knew that the loans they were making were going to go bad. They were trying to sell them to somebody else, ultimately expecting them to end up with some sovereign wealth fund. And now you had at the beginning of the show McCain saying that this is the result of fraud and incompetence. The government's now bailed them out. But by bailing them out, Wall Street was coming to terms with the bad debts. When Bear Stearns went under and when Lehman Brothers went under, this began to wipe away the bad debts. And when the debts exceed the ability to pay, there's only one thing any economy can do, and that's wipe them out. Instead, the government is trying to keep the fiction alive. And what Paulson did yesterday in bailing out AIG was to try to lock in whoever is the next president, not only to further bailouts of Wall Street, ostensibly to protect the public money, but to make it impossible to write down the debts of the 4 million homeowners that are expected to default this year, impossible to write down the debts of companies that have issued junk bonds, impossible for the country to get rid of this excess of debts that can't be repaid, and you're having really a war now of creditors against debtors. And this is what Wall Street's been preparing for. It needed an emergency to do it. It's really not an emergency at all. This has been building up for many years. Everybody expected it. And breathlessly now, the Secretary
of
Treasury.
But of course, the argument was if you don't bail out AIG, it could lead to a global financial meltdown.
It's a meltdown of the gamblers, as Naomi said. These are people who've gambled. You had McCain saying they're gamblers. If these people have gambled, we're talking about derivative trades, billions of dollars of bets on which way interest rates will go, billions of dollars of bad loans beyond the ability of debtors to pay. Why on earth would you want to bail out these creditors?
So what would happen if you didn't?
Then you would prepare the ground for writing down the debts of the homeowners that have no way of repaying the exploding mortgages. Those interest rates are going to be jumping up this year. You'd be able to bring the debts down to the ability of the economy to pay, and you'd save these 4 million homeowners from defaulting and being kicked out of their houses. Now they're going to be kicked out of the houses. The houses will be vacant. The cities are going to now say, gee, we're going to have to cut the property taxes to enable the debts to be paid to save the financial system. So if they cut the property taxes, they're going to have to cut back local expenditures, local infrastructure. The economy is being sacrificed to pay the gamblers.
Naomi Prinz, how has Wall Street changed and how does this meet everyday people? Lehman bankrupt, you've got AIG nationalized, same with Freddie and Fannie. You've got the takeover of Merrill Lynch, now part of Bank of America, happened over a weekend.
It's insane, actually. It's bad math, and it's a bad precedent because they're not simply bailing it out with putting taxpayers' money through the Fed into taking on the risks of these companies. They're taking on risks. They're not bailing out and selling debt. They're taking on the risk. They're becoming, the Fed is continuing to become a larger and larger hedge fund. And it's doing it with taxpayer money, and it's doing it with the future debt of the United States. So for the one thing, they're not attaching any rules to these bailouts. You know, you bail out Bear Stearns, effectively you're putting up $30 billion to take Bear Stearns' junk and say, all right, we'll back the junk. J.P. Morgan Chase, you take Bear Stearns. We'll back whatever junk is there. But there's no decision to say, but, you know, you got to tell us what's there. And J.P. Morgan, by the way, as you're taking on this bank, you have to explain to us what you really have. And Bank of America, you have to explain to us what your risks are. I know that at Bank of America, they were struggling with their own risks and trying to figure out what was going on in their own company. And now they've assumed Merrill Lynch. That creates a tremendous institution where the Fed is now obligated when that starts to have more and more trouble,
what
which it will.
What started all this?
What started all this is a complete lack of transparency and regulation in the banking system. If we go back to a history where we had a similar situation on Wall Street, which was 1929, when we had a stock market crash followed by a Great Depression. In 1932, when FDR was elected and Herbert Hoover was ousted, right after that, we put together
FDR didn't come in on a plank of changing everything the way he did. It happened, didn't it, after he became president.
He had to take a look at the banking system, which was undermining the general economy, which had undermined the general economy, and say, you know what, we do not understand what's going on here. We have two types of banks. We have speculating investment banks, and we have commercial banks that deal with the public, take deposits, take savings, make mortgage loans, understand what's going on. We'll back those. The government will back those commercial institutions that deal with the public. It will not back speculative investment banks. And by the way, those two things have to split. You pick a side. You want to be an investment bank, you be an investment bank. You want to be a commercial bank, we'll back you. The Fed will back you. We will be there. We'll create an insurance company, the FDIC, to back deposits for the public. We'll have your back. There was no agreement to have the back of the speculative investment banks. Over the years, these things have merged and merged and merged. And in late 1999, Glass-Steagall, that act was repealed, killed, died in Congress. And now you have a situation where everything that went wrong up until the creation of that act is happening now with a lot more capital and a lot more international interplay and a lot more money on the federal government to have to bail out when things go wrong. So we've gone backwards in banking history, and having Merrill be a part of Bank of America is a tremendously big accident waiting to happen. Bear Stearns is assets part of J.P. Morgan. They're all part of recombining speculation and commercial.
We've got to go to break. When we come back, Michael Hudson, advisor to former presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich, I want to ask about the current presidential candidates right now, their proposals, the main party candidates, McCain and Obama. This is Democracy Now! Our guests are Nomi Prins. She worked at a lot of these places that are going under now, being taken over, going bankrupt. Michael Hudson, professor. President of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, Chief Economic Advisor Dennis Kucinich. Stay with us. Easy Star All Stars singing Money. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Major party presidential candidates Barack Obama and John McCain addressed the financial crisis on the campaign trail this week. Obama accused McCain of not understanding the seriousness of the crisis.
We are in the most serious financial crisis in generations. Yet Senator McCain stood up yesterday and said that the fundamentals of the economy are strong. That's what he said. Now, a few hours later, his campaign sent him back out to clean up his remarks. And he tried to explain himself again this morning by saying that what he meant to say was that the American workers are strong. But we know that Senator McCain meant what he said the first time because he has said it over and over again throughout this campaign.
Meanwhile, John McCain tried to strike a populist tone on the campaign trail.
While employees, shareholders, and other victims are left with nothing but trouble and debt, the people who helped cause the collapse make off with tens of millions in severance packages. Disgraceful. I've spoken out against the excess of corporate executives, and I can assure you that if I'm president, we're not going to tolerate that anymore.
Professor
his
Hudson.
Constituency. His constituency are the people who've caused the crisis. That's who he's representing. Now, of course, you're not going to come in and say, I'm going to support the people who've caused this crisis at your expense. If you're going to bail out your constituency, you're going to say exactly the opposite. So what he's saying has no reality at all. These are the people who are saying there is no money for Social Security. We're going to have to privatize it. We're going to have to turn over your Social Security to Bear Stearns, to AIG, to the very people who've shown how they're mismanaging money. Imagine if the Republican program had gone through and Social Security had been privatized and these were the jokers who were managing your Social Security. They'd stick you with the losses. So these are his constituency. He knows he's not telling the truth. He's not paid to tell the truth. He's pretending that it's a crisis that has to be bailed out, that it's the financial system. But it's not the financial system that's being bailed out. It's the debt system. And it's the debts that the homeowners own and the industry owns. And now the government's coming on the side of the creditors who are going to close down the industries, sell them off to pay the debts, foreclose on the houses, sell them off to pay the debts, and the economy is going to shrink and shrink. That's the program that they're standing
They've
for.
They've always said that Social Security can't be bailed out,
then
but that it's going
they
broke.
Out? They've already spent $5 trillion in the last 2 weeks to double the size of the national debt by taking over Fannie Mae. How can they bail out the gamblers? How can they bail out Wall Street and not claim that the Social Security system doesn't really exist? They've used the Social Security money basically for the bailout. There it goes. They've made a choice. The choice is to bail out Wall Street against the people. The Treasury is supposed to represent the government and the economy, and the Fed is supposed to be the board of directors of commercial banks. But now Wall Street plays both sides of the game. It not only supplies the heads of the Fed, it supplies the Secretary of the Treasury. And that's why I said the class war is back in business with a vengeance.
Noemi Prinz, you worked at a number of these places like Bear Stearns. You worked at Lehman Brothers, too, now bankrupt. Let's talk about the money that Obama and McCain get. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Obama, it's nearly $10 million from the securities investment industry. McCain, it's nearly $7 million. So Obama actually gets more. Employees of Merrill Lynch, the investment bank that's been taken over by Bank of America, have given the largest corporate money to Senator McCain's campaign. Merrill employees giving some close to $300,000 to McCain, close to $200,000 to Obama. Lehman Brothers, which filed for bankruptcy, has been the eighth largest corporate giver to Senator Obama's campaign. Democrats have become increasingly reliant on Wall Street money. The industry ranks as the third biggest giver to Senator Obama's presidential campaign. How does this influence the debate, and what are the proposals of the two men?
Well, the proposals of McCain have to do with, well, they're very nondescript. Basically, he says there's a greed situation, we need to contain it.
And we have to set up a commission.
We need to set up a commission to understand what's going on. Well, we have seven different regulatory bodies in Washington and are supposed to be watching various aspects of the financial community. And we have state ones that are supposed to be watching over insurance companies. So we actually have regulatory agencies. And Obama has basically said the same thing. He wants to strengthen the ones that do exist. The problem is being connected to Wall Street in terms of your funding and Washington in general. Wall Street in general was the biggest contributor to all of the politicians in Washington over the last decade. It's where the most money comes from. So you have a situation where that money doesn't want oversight, even when it so badly, as Michael was talking about, mismanages and over-leverages and over-bets and gets into such a tremendous problem that we haven't seen, they don't want the regulation. What you should do, what the candidate should do, is step back and say, okay, well, you know what? Instead of having them dictate the terms and us coming in to bail them out with no strings attached, we'll bail you out, and we won't even ask you to explain to us what the heck has been going on with your balance sheets. We're taking stuff on we don't even understand. Actually have to make it transparent and actually have to dissect the businesses back into a form where speculative businesses and commercial businesses are once again separated, at least until our government can understand what's going on and understand the hook onto which they're taking American public money to bail them out.
Professor Hudson, Phil Graham was the top advisor to McCain. What was his role in all of this?
He's the front man for the biggest crooks in the country. Basically, he says, don't regulate. He's responded to the lobbies by cutting back all of the information. The regulatory agencies don't collect the information to let them know what's happening. The government has no adequate statistics on what the value of real estate is, what the amount of debt is, because if it did have statistics, it would show that the volume of debt is far in excess of the ability of debtors to pay. And when you have that, you'd have to do something about it. Graham has said, don't collect statistics, because if you know how these guys are making money, they're going to pay taxes on it. And if you don't look at what they're doing, if you let them all do it through offshore vehicles, if you let them all bury everything, then they're not going to be taxed. And that's his constituency, to untax finance and to shift it on to labor and industry.
Where does Glass-Steagall fit into this?
That, as Naomi said, Glass-Steagall was designed to prevent what has happened. It was designed to keep investment banking apart from commercial banking. Now you have the banking system merging with the most crooked companies in the country, like Countrywide Financial, that's under indictment by attorney generals all over the country. You're having the banking system commit its deposits and its base to recycle the savings not into industrial investment, but into exploitive loans.
Maybe injecting a little humor here, could this lead to single-payer health care? I mean, we're talking about nationalizing of insurance.
You might as well nationalize
and
insurance.
And why does that have to be humorous?
Well, no, exactly right. If you're effectively nationalizing a portion of the banking, you're nationalizing the worst portion of the banking system is what you're effectively nationalizing. But you're not even doing that because you're not running as a public entity. You're taking on risk you won't be able to understand, and you're not even trying to. So it's even more dangerous. With health insurance, which actually those companies have not sort of been involved in this because they haven't had the same derivatives type of financial services speculative activity that AIG has under its umbrella, which is the real reason it is imploding, you could actually put some money into something that preempts a problem happening and helps people get health care.
What do you see has to happen now, and are we going to see a lot more banks going down? Professor Hudson.
You'll see big fish eat little fish. The strong are going to win out. The people who are not going to be bailed out are going to be the pension funds, the labor funds, the small investors. You're going to, the government's come down on the side of the sharks. And what they did yesterday is to lock in and prevent any Democratic administration from coming in and cleaning up the mess. The people who've made the mess are now in control.
But Obama's not against this.
You know, that's true. He's not against it. And it was, after all, a Democratic president, Clinton, who repealed Glass-Steagall. It was a Democratic Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin, who supported all of this. So they're the
top advisor to Obama.
That's right, the Treasury Secretary. Yes, and still the top advisor. So you've had both the, I guess you could say the Republicans are a wholly owned subsidiary of Wall Street. The Democrats are a partially owned subsidiary.
Naomi Prinz.
Well, yeah, Robert Rubin was at Goldman. So is the current Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson. So are a number of people in Washington. And you have that situation where you have people with speculative sort of minds running this concept of free market through Washington, which has created this complete catastrophe in the financial sector. It will get worse, because the fact is these new conglomerates, the J.P. Morgan, Bear Stearns, the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, they are larger, more risky entities than they were before the happening. And they have not disclosed the risks that they have. I worked in some of these companies. You cannot merge risks. You cannot merge risk systems between the products within your own company. So when you start merging tremendously big companies, there is no hope in any sort of short time frame that you are going to actually understand that risk. And there's no need to report it to our government because it's not required. So it will get worse.
Naomi used the word free markets. Obviously, this is not a free market. They say they're acting on behalf of Adam Smith. Adam Smith said that no government has ever repaid its debts, and it could be said that no private sector has either. So this is not a free market. This is a guaranteed gamble for Wall Street against industry and against
the labor. You each have 30 seconds. You're being called in by Senator McCain and Senator Obama to make your recommendation to them. They'd maybe give you 15 seconds if they give you that. But Naomi Prinz, what are you going to tell them?
It's very simple. You don't understand the system. So you know what? You take some guts and you create a situation where you dissect the system. You don't merge it. You dissect it and you make accountable what is going on within each segment of the speculative and commercial banks so you know what's going on, as was had to do in 1933, because that will create an actual stable system that the government can actually understand and
quantify, Professor Hudson?
You realize the debts can't be repaid, and you're going to write down the debts to the ability of the debtors to
pay.
You're
not bailing out any of these companies.
That's right, you don't. They knew they were bad debts. They knew they were bad loans. You don't bail out the people who knew the debts were going to go bad and thought that they'd bought the government to bail them out. You say, we're not going to bail you out, and you haven't bought us, and we're going to act on behalf of the economy and the voters, not your behalf.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Naomi Prinz, former investment banker turned journalist. She worked at Bear Stearns. She worked at Lehman. She's now a senior fellow at Demos. Michael Hudson is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, chief economic advisor to Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, a professor at University of Missouri, Kansas City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we turn north, as we head to Alaska, we turn to the environment. Scientists from the World Wildlife Fund have warned polar bears and other rare species could become extinct because of the rapid melting of the Arctic sea ice. They say that less ice is predicted in the Arctic this year than in any other. Now the Republican vice presidential candidate, Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin, has tried to sue the U.S. government over the listing of polar bears as a threatened species. She's also denied that global warming is caused by human activity. But in an interview last week with ABC's Charlie Gibson, the governor seemed to display a change of heart.
Do you still believe that global warming is not man-made?
I believe that man's activities certainly can be contributing to the issue of global warming, climate change. Regardless of that, John McCain and I agree that we got to do something about it, and we have to make sure that we're doing all we can to cut down on pollution.
But it's a critical point as to whether or not this is man-made. He says it is. You have said in the past it's not.
The debate on that even really has evolved into, okay, here's where we are now. Scientists do show us that there are changes in climate. Things are getting warmer. Now, what do we do about it?
Yes, but isn't it critical as to whether or not it's man-made? Because what you do about it depends on whether it's man-made.
That's why I'm attributing some of man's activities to potentially causing some of the changes in the climate right now. So,
but I, call me a cynic, but I hear a little bit of change in your policy there when you say, yes, now you're beginning to say it is man-made. Sounds to me like you're adapting your position to Senator McCain's.
I think you are a cynic, because show me where I've ever said that there's absolute proof that nothing that man has ever conducted or engaged in has had any effect or no effect on climate change. I have not said that. I have said that my belief is there is a cyclical nature of our planet, warming trends, cooling trends.
That's false. According to a Fairbanks, Alaska newspaper, less than a year ago, Palin did disagree, saying, quote, "I'm not an Al Gore doom and gloom environmentalist blaming the changes in our climate on human activity."
An excerpt of ABC's interview with Governor Sarah Palin. Well, Rick Steiner is with us now. He's a marine conservation specialist professor at the University of Alaska, has tried to uncover the scientific basis for Palin's opposition to any new federal protections for polar bears under the Endangered Species Act. When he requested the assessment of state scientists of Alaska who'd examine the impact of global warming on polar bears, he was told he might have to pay close to $500,000 for the request to be processed. Professor Steiner finally obtained the documents through a federal records request and found the state's marine mammal scientists were actually at odds with Palin's position. They'd agreed with federal researchers' conclusions that polar bears are threatened with extinction because of a shrinking ice cap. Professor Rick Steiner joins us now from Anchorage, Alaska. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much, Amy. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Professor Steiner, talk about what happened. Talk about Governor Palin's position, what she put forward, why she sued Alaska, why she sued the government, and where you came into the story.
Be delighted to. First of all, a little context. Alaska, big business here is producing hydrocarbons. And so Alaska's in the business of producing carbon that ultimately winds up into the global atmosphere. So there's this inherent political tension between the big business in Alaska, oil and gas, and the notion that carbon emissions are causing climate change that's ground zero impacts right here in Alaska. So there's that. Anybody who runs for office in Alaska has to embrace totally the oil and gas business in order to have a chance of getting elected. That's sort of the politic here. When Governor Palin was running for the governor's mansion, she supported more oil and gas development and never mentioned a thing about the threat of climate change here in Alaska. What I wanted, as soon as she took office, is when Dirk Kempthorne, the Secretary of the Interior, announced that indeed polar bears were in danger. They were proposing to list them under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. Immediately after that, Governor Palin, this is in December of 06 or January of 07, called him and opposed the listing before they'd ever looked at the science. Subsequent to that, the state's marine mammal experts, and there's only three or four of them on the state payroll, looked at the federal proposed rule to list polar bears, sent a nice long memo that basically concluded that, yes, the federal science behind the listing, you know, documenting that polar bears are indeed threatened, was solid science, and they agreed with it. Later in the year, the USGS, which does most of the research on polar bears, United States Geological Survey, put out 9 studies. This was in September of 07. And again, the state's marine mammal scientists were asked to comment, to review that science, comment on it. They did, and they found that the conclusions were solid. That was the scientific work that predicted that 2/3 of the world's polar bears would be gone by mid-century, and all of the polar bears off of Alaska would be gone. And then they had a caveat about that, saying they thought that was a conservative estimate and that it would probably happen faster than that. So here you have the state's marine mammal experts, 3 or 4 of them, very reputable scientists, agreeing with the federal proposed rule to list polar bears and with the USGS studies showing that polar bears are in serious trouble, yet the governor maintaining her political position that polar bears are not threatened by anything and they're opposing the listing. So what you had essentially was a situation where the governor made a political decision, not a scientific-based one, to oppose the listing. Secondly, she misrepresented the basis of her decision to the public, saying it was based on science when indeed it really wasn't. And then thirdly, tried to conceal all of that when I was simply asking for that scientific review to be released. So there's 3 red flags there for the public.
So you try to get the information. What is it exactly you were requesting from Alaska, from the state government?
Sure. The state, as many states do, has sort of an analog to the Federal Freedom of Information Act here. It's called the Alaska Public Records Act. And under that act, citizens are entitled to information on what their government is up to, which is a fundamental tenet of democratic governance, certainly. So the governor had written an op-ed in the New York Times a year or so ago saying that she made her decision to oppose polar bear listing based on a comprehensive review of the science. And so I simply wanted that. You know, I found it very implausible that the scientists that I knew involved in marine mammal science in Alaska would have actually opposed the federal science behind the listing, because there is an overwhelming body of scientific thought and consensus that we're in a very warming situation in Alaska. It's caused by carbon emissions. Arctic sea ice is reducing catastrophically, and that is the habitat for polar bears, and therefore polar bears are in serious trouble. So that's what I wanted. I started the request in December of 07, and it took about, the first response I got from the Commissioner of Fish and Game was, well, you know, it'll cost you $468,000 for us to process this response. And so I sequentially narrowed the request, and it got down to $8,000, $7,000. But still, I should have deserved a fee waiver as a faculty member with the State University in Alaska, requesting this information on what our government is contending.
You were asking for emails.
To get it to the public. I was asking for any documents, emails. I was specifically wanting the review by the state marine mammal experts of the federal proposed rule to list.
So you finally get it under the Federal Freedom of Information Act.
Well, that's right. It took me 6 months to get to know from the state of Alaska, from the Palin administration. They ultimately got an attorney general's opinion that they would not release this one document that I wanted. which was the State Science Review, claiming that it was a deliberative, pre-decisional document, and they had executive privilege to do so. So then they said I could take them to court if I wanted to. And I found another way. I sent a FOIA request to the federal government, the Fish and Wildlife Service, that I suspected probably had it. They did. I got it, and you have it now. And it's very clear from that and another email that they accidentally released to me, the state, that the marine mammal scientists agreed completely with the conclusions and the methodologies and the thinking process behind all of the body of federal science that was used to argue for the threatened listing.
How unusual is this level of secrecy, your attempts to get at a basic scientific document or a recommendation from state scientists on whether polar bears are endangered? I mean, she used this supposed report that no one could see to actually sue the federal government to keep polar bears off the endangered species list.
Well, the lawsuit is kind of perplexing at this point, because what you have here is the experts for the plaintiff, which would be the state of Alaska, agreeing with the experts for the defendant, the U.S. government, that, yeah, the science says that polar bears are in serious trouble and that something should be done to afford them additional protection. So, many people here recommended that the state not pursue the lawsuit simply because it didn't make much sense. And also, the lawsuit puts the state of Alaska, and particularly the Palin administration, to the political right of the Bush-Cheney administration. And that's a rarefied land where few venture. If you think about that, it gives an ominous pale to what a Palin-McCain administration would be should they prevail in November. So even the Bush administration could not find a way around the science on climate change, Arctic sea ice reduction, and polar bear threat. Yet the Palin administration took the far extreme right position on that and is suing. I still think they will not prevail in the lawsuit. I hope they won't. Here we have their own experts agreeing with the experts for the defendants, the federal government. And I think it was as much politics and posturing and things as it was legitimate legal maneuvering. I think they're going to lose the lawsuit. The federal government is, as I said, if they could have found a way around the science, they certainly would have. But it is so overwhelming, and the consensus is strong. So,
last quick question, Professor Rick Steiner. Governor Palin is being hailed as a person who took on oil and gas, increased taxes against the big oil in Alaska, and yet you're contending she's in their pocket.
Yeah, you know, it's this whole issue of I'm tough on oil. She has, with the legislature, raised taxes and royalties off the oil companies here. That's something that people here have wanted and asked for probably the last decade or so. This was not a new novel proposal. And so they did accomplish that, and we're very, very delighted that that happened. So there's more monies into the public hands than into corporate hands, and that's a good thing. However, she's very sympathetic with the oil and gas companies on virtually everything, and there's nowhere in Alaska that we know that she has said should be off limits to additional oil and gas drilling. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, virtually the entire offshore area in the Arctic Ocean, the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea, which are the remaining polar bear habitat in Alaska, fish-rich Bristol Bay, where 28 million sockeye salmon were caught this year. She supports oil and gas drilling out in that bay and in Cook Inlet, Alaska.
So, of course, the Republican delegates on the floor of the convention are all wearing the hard hats that said drill now. Governor Palin has said that what is drilling in 2,000-mile swath of 20 million, acres of, she's talking about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, she said people outside Alaska just don't understand we need this for self-sufficiency.
Yeah, and that's a ludicrous argument from an energy policy standpoint. We're not going to drill our way out of this. The problem with energy that we knew 30 years ago is that we were wasting at least half of the oil and gas that we were producing and using in our phenomenally inefficient energy economy in this country. What we need to do is a rapid transition to a sustainable energy economy. We know exactly how to do that with energy efficiency subsidies, and remove the subsidies from oil and gas and nuclear and things like that, and then providing subsidies and tax breaks for alternatives. We know how to do this, but, you know, the Palin-McCain side, I had some faith in the McCain arguments prior to this, but with picking Palin, it's very obvious their entire energy policy is going to be drill, drill, drill. They've been very obvious about that, rather than transitioning to the sustainable economy that we know we need. And the other one last thing is on this notion of government transparency and honesty and ethics and things like that. I look at those as verbs, not as nouns. You have to be transparent, and not just declare that you are transparent and honest. You have to be it every morning that you wake up and start governing. And that's what we need to look for in our next occupants at the White House, I think.
Professor Rick Steiner, I want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Anchorage, Alaska, where over the weekend, when Governor Palin returned to Alaska after receiving and giving her nomination speech in St. Paul, there was the largest protest in history, actually, of Alaska against her, even though the mainstream media basically just showed the reception when she came back to the Anchorage airport, the hangar where people were waiting for her. There were over 1,500 people who protested her return. This is Democracy Now! Our guest was Rick Steiner, professor of the University of Alaska, Anchorage, Maine conservation specialist. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go south to Bolivia. Stay with us. Aymara, una kuna kanchi, abla yala manta hatari kukuna, nukanchi kai pika sakunchi, waranka waranka wata manta pacha, chaira kutak ni wanchi, halpas ni yu, runa kuna nispa, ni tak angga chikuna chichu, ayu runa kuna kas kanchita, arsus ki jesus ki ji, wita mistus ki winya, yasu ni ataki, winya kaka ni ataki, hani haniwa, hamra kas ni ataki, humas na yas, hachadashu ni ataki, hamra kasi nalbi, ampi, Waranka 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 na kawa Waranka 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 na kawa Aymar mar kaha wilang pitu baka tari Uka suti na kakel kanya perkaro kel kanyani Aymar ake jo hafsa tarsiwa Jaman bi hudas kiwa Aymar ake jo hafsa tarsiwa Jaman bi hudas kiwa Aymar ake jo hafsa tarsiwa Jaman bi hudas kiwa Aymara que yo asalta siwa Chama mi hutas kiwa This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A fragile dialogue between the Bolivian government and its opponents seemed to inch forward Tuesday as President Evo Morales and opposition governors from the country's restive eastern provinces agreed to begin talks. They'd previously appeared to break down when the Bolivian army arrested one of the opposition governors, Leopoldo Fernandez, from the Rightist Podemos opposition party. The attorney general accused the governor of genocide. He'd governed the province of Pando, where between 15 and 30 pro-Morales peasants were killed last week. Speaking in La Paz Tuesday, President Morales said he hoped to reach a pact with the opposition governors.
The governor of the Department of Tarija, following the instructions of his department and in the name of four other governors, came to help in the efforts made by the vice president of the republic. At this moment, talks continue. I called an emergency meeting of the social movements that are also in the government's house revising the document that has been moving forward until now, because it is not about making an agreement that some regions won't follow later. Twice I have heard leaders ask that they lift the roadblocks, but they don't do it because they are not taking into account their request. We hope that in the course of the day, we can agree on the points proposed up until now.
Meanwhile, the Peace Corps has withdrawn its 2,500 volunteers from Bolivia. The State Department's organizing at least two evacuation flights for U.S. citizens who want to leave the country. The White House has also placed Bolivia, as well as Burma and Venezuela, on a list of states that had failed demonstrably to meet their counter-narcotics obligations. Assistant Secretary of State David Johnson noted the Drug Enforcement Administration was forced to move its operations from Chapare, one of Bolivia's largest coca-producing areas, last week. Speaking on Tuesday, he said Bolivia has failed to act aggressively against the cultivation and trafficking of illegal drugs.
This is the first year that the president has determined that Bolivia has failed demonstrably. This was not a hasty decision. Bolivia does have a number of effective U.S.-supported coca eradication and cocaine interdiction programs. However, Bolivia remains a major narcotics-producing country, and its official policies and actions have caused a significant deterioration in its cooperation with the United States. President Morales continues to support the expansion of licit coca leaf production, despite the fact that current legal cultivation far exceeds the demand for legal traditional consumption and exceeds the area permitted under Bolivian law. Much of the surplus coca leaf production is traded in unregulated, so-called legal markets, and is diverted to cocaine production.
We turn right now to journalist Martin Sivak. He's written four books on Bolivia. His latest is a best-selling biography of Evo Morales. It's called Jefazo, which translates to Big Boss. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Your response to what's happening?
Yeah, I think that, as you said, there's no place for a national rig agreement. However, I don't buy this foreign approach to Bolivia that claims that Bolivia is going to go to a civil war. I think there's space for negotiation. That's the eager of President Morales. I think that there's space to combine both agendas, the autonomy agenda and the national constitution. At the same time, the conflict will persist because there's really an important clash. Evo Morales, the agrarian reform, the nationalization, and the inclusion of minorities, that's the hallmark, the main points of his government, it's going to be always receiving a rejection from the eastern part of the country.
We're also joined on the phone by Jim Schultz. He's with the Democracy Center in Cochabamba. He's actually right now speaking to us from Argentina and has been running a blog on Bolivia that can be found at democracyctrcenter.org. Jim, the U.S. involvement in all of this, telling all Americans to leave, the Peace Corps pulling out, now putting them on the list with Burma and Venezuela?
Well, you know, first of all, thanks for paying attention to the story again, Amy. You can watch, when you listen to the Secretary of State and you watch the events this week, you can see the United States isolating itself in Latin America almost by the hour. I mean, here you have the presidents of South America meeting in an emergency session in Chile to figure out how to help Bolivia, and Washington's busy whining about one ambassador being sent back and still hasn't commented on the fact that 30 people at least, probably many more, were massacred by the opposition. So, I mean, I think this is a watershed week for the United States basically painting itself almost out of the loop in terms of Latin America.
I mean, significant that it was hosted, this emergency meeting, by one of the moderates of Latin America, Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile. The significance—
I also think it's significant that it was the two women presidents that convened this.
Your response to that, Martin Sivak, and what does this all mean?
I think that, you know, the decision of Evo Morales to increase Bolivian sovereignty in terms of designation of top officers in the drug, in the war against drug, in terms of economy, it's a turning point in the relationship between Bolivia and the U.S. And now we are seeing the reaction of the U.S. to this new national sovereignty.
Jim Schultz, do you think the U.S. is trying to topple Morales?
Well, that's been speculation on the internet all week, and I think it's not black and white. I think the ambassador, Philip Goldberg, was an extraordinarily arrogant and incompetent diplomat. And for him to go and meet with these opposition governors on the eve of their launching these attacks on Morales and calling for his resignation, I mean, what he said to them is known to them and the ambassador, but he is beyond clueless in terms of how this appears in Bolivia and the rest of Latin America.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. We'll certainly continue to follow what is taking place in Bolivia. Our guest, Jim Schultz, Executive Director of Democracy Center and Cochabamba, Bolivia, and Martin Sivak, journalist. He lives here, though spent many years in Bolivia. His latest book, Jefazo, Big Boss, about Evo Morales. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, who produced Aaron Mata, Angelique Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Peter Curries, our engineers. On Thursday, I'll be at Hofstra at 4 o'clock, University in Long Island, and then in the evening in Manhasset, Universalist Church. Go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.